Welcome back to the Anaheim Calling podcast. We've been away for a little bit, but Jake and I have returned to break down some decent bit of news here. A lot of contracts being signed in the Ducks universe the past couple of weeks, a couple of which we're going to get into here shortly. Jake, how have you been? We haven't done a pod in, I mean, like 2 weeks.
I know.
Are you okay?
I'm doing good. I'm doing all right. Just,
Angels baseball is keeping you afloat?
No, not really. I mean,
Premier League started. Close to pitching again.
Premier League started yesterday. Tottenham picked up the win. A good 2-1 win against Newcastle. I'm happy. George was kind of sad that Newcastle lost, but we're all good. I'm happy.
Newcastle's in the Premier League?
Newcastle is in the Premier League.
I thought they were out of it for a while.
They were out 2 years ago. They came back up last year.
Okay.
And then just wedding planning.
Oh.
Lots to keep me busy. Lots to keep me busy.
Yeah, more than enough. All right. Well,
let me ask you this. How was your trip to the Great White North?
Ah, yes. Yeah, I spent just about 8 days in Canada. Visited some family in the Ottawa area, so that was wonderful. The traveling itself, not quite as wonderful. Airlines, airports, delays, cancellations. It was I got it all on my trip, so I'm pretty happy to be back in the friendly confines of Orange County. Let's just put it that way. My last flight, connecting flight from Washington, D.C. to Ottawa, at like 2 a.m., they announced that the flight was canceled after being delayed 3 hours. Had to spend a night in a hotel, get to the hotel, and they tell me that, oh, we're out of rooms, but we have a meeting room open. You can sleep on the couch if you'd like. And I was just like, can we do a little better than that by any chance? And so at 5 a.m., they got me a room. So that was before I even got to Canada. So it was a little brutal. But
an adventure.
Anyway, yeah, it was an adventure, to say the least. But let's get into the news because there is a decent amount to talk about here. Let's start things off with the Brandon Montour contract extension, which on our last podcast, I think we had – the contract had not been signed yet. I think that the arbitration hearing had been scheduled, but before it got to that, the two parties, the Ducks and the Montour, were able to agree to a 2-year contract with a $3.387 million annual average value. And so Montour gets the bridge deal. Now he's going to have 2 seasons to basically establish that he is a bona fide top four defenseman and that he can get a big raise the next time around. So right now Brandon Montour is 24 years of age. I think by the time his next contract is, or by the time this contract is up, he will be, I think, 26 or going on 27, but he will be an RFA once again with arbitration rights. So he's not going into unrestricted free agency. It's a bit of a quirk there, but he's going to get up. Well, let's just get into it then before we kind of start extrapolating. So what do you think of the deal?
I think it's probably fair value. I mean, we were talking a little bit before, and if you look at Cap Friendly's comparable contracts, the Jacob Trouba one is a pretty good comparison to it. He had signed his at 22 years of age. It was a 2-year bridge deal worth $3 million. Granted, Trouba was also an RFA without arbitration rights, so he had less leverage than Montour, which is, I think, one of the reasons why Montour was able to get this deal. I think it's about fair. I mean, Montour wanted somewhere in the $4 million range, and the Ducks wanted him at 2.5, and so this kind of split the middle. It gets him 2 years to kind of, it's a prove it deal is the best way to put it. I mean, he probably could have gotten a longer term deal if he had wanted to, but then the cap hit may have gone down a little bit. But I think the real interesting thing is that he's still going to be an RFA at the end of the deal.
Right. And so that's where I think that this, to me, this deal is a pretty big win for the Ducks. And I think it's a good deal for Montour, but it's a better deal for the Ducks. A couple of reasons here. So one is that although Montour, I thought, had a really strong finish to last season, you know, we saw what he could do when you finally put him with someone not named Francois Beauchemin as his partner.
Yeah.
Him and Cam Fowler performed really well. And that hasn't always been the case where Fowler has had a functional pairing or functional partner. And so for that to really be a solid second pairing or a 1A, 1B pairing, whatever you want to call it, with Lindholm and Manson, that has a lot of value for Anaheim. Now, we're only talking about maybe 500 or so minutes at 5-on-5. And so we still need a larger sample. But just based off that, I think it's a worthy gamble for the Ducks. We know Montour has a lot more to add on the power play if they can ever use him properly. And it sounds like that may happen with some of the shuffling behind the bench. We'll see. So I think the money is just about right. The term is really what's great here, because Anaheim's going to be able to find out, what do we really have in Brandon Montour?
Yep.
These are probably going to be two of his most productive seasons. And so I think it's a big win. And then, you know, and the thing is, because of that limited sample of what we've seen, if it doesn't work out, then the Ducks aren't in a position where they can, you know, go in another route, go another direction, or just, once again, he's cost controlled. So I think it's a pretty big win for Anaheim here.
Completely agree with that. Yeah. Yeah, it's one of those things where kind of at the end of this deal, you kind of have a couple options. If he does impress, then you can go longer term with him. You then have a bigger sample size. I mean, the guy only has, as much as we were talking about, he was great this past year. He's only has 107 games played. And right. So that's really not that much. And so it's kind of giving you a little bit more protection as a franchise from someone just having a hot little start to his career. But it also allows Montour to kind of prove it and make more money, because sometimes what you'll see, and granted, a lot of people talk about Ricard Raquel's deal as one that's the best deal in the league with how much he's making. And I think if you were to tell Raquel that, he would kind of be a little pissed off, to be honest, because he's making way less than he should. And it's because he had got locked into this long-term deal as an RFA. And so it's kind of, I think, something, at least in this specific case, that's going to be good for both the player and the franchise. So I can't really complain too much about it.
Right. And one thing that's interesting with Montour is that if you kind of look back at his trail to the NHL, obviously went through the USHL and then played a bit, and you know, at the NCAA level, but really that extra year where he played in San Diego, it feels like, I mean, and he had such a great season there, you know, putting up 57 points in 68 games, which is kind of nuts for a defenseman. You wonder if the Ducks maybe missed out on a good season from him there. It's interesting to think about, because the year where he was in San Diego, everyone was clamoring for him to come up, and the Ducks never did it. And you kind of wonder if they could have gotten another productive season out of Montour, because realistically he's 24 now, and I'm not saying he's old by any means, but the best seasons are probably, you know, there's probably, I'd say, two to three more, but then it's probably going to start declining a little bit. So if they could have gotten another productive season, or I guess an upswing season, that could have been something to consider. But again, we're probably splitting hairs at this point.
Playing devil's advocate a bit, how much more value would that have added to his contract, or how much AAV?
Well, that's the thing. Keeping him in, San Diego, yeah. Although it may have hurt, I mean, it probably hurt him more than it hurt the Ducks, I guess. Yeah. I guess is a good way to put it. Yeah, because if he's in the NHL that season, who knows how good he would have been, and maybe he asks for more this time around. So I think, like you said, it's a win for the Ducks, and I mean, it really solidifies their top four now for the next 2 years. We're going to know pretty much exactly who's going to be there, barring some kind of injury. So let's hope for no catastrophic event there. But let's get to the big one here, and literally it's a lot bigger. It's an 8-year deal for $51.2 million for John Gibson. So we've been talking about this all season. Gibson, who was on that very team-friendly deal, signs a massive extension. The average annual value is going to be $6.4 million a year. No signing bonuses, so none of the trickery we've seen with the likes of the Tavares contracts. There is a modified no-trade clause. It's a 10-team no-trade list that kicks in for the 2021-2022 season. And it's a very interesting deal. And it got a lot of press, you could say, especially on a slow news day in August. So, Jake, what was your gut reaction when you first saw the deal, and kind of where are you at on this whole situation?
Gut reaction was cap hit's really good, really, really good. It's honestly, it's probably a bit undervalued in terms of how much or how great he's been over the past three seasons and how much he's probably going to be making. My only concern, and granted, this is not anything with Gibson overall, this is just my personal opinion on goaltender contracts, is anything over 5 years gets me concerned, just because Goaltending can be voodoo from time to time, and sometimes it's hard to get stuck with that because if it becomes very hard to move that contract and that player if they do somehow decline. But at the end of the day, we've seen the past three seasons that Gibson's been one of the best goaltenders in the league, and sometimes you got to pony up and give up the big years to kind of lock him down long term. And so I can't really complain. I'm happy with him. I'm happy he's going to be a Duck. There's the potential for him after these 8 years to go down as the best goaltender in Ducks history, and they've locked him up like he's going to be. I think this is the first contract that the Ducks would have given in the salary cap era that's over 4 or 5 years to a goaltender, and so it's a big deal.
Right, absolutely. It's really a major commitment from the franchise to the player, and I think, you know, where are you at with the injury concerns? Because obviously that is kind of the undercurrent of all these discussions surrounding this contract, is that although Gibson has been so great the last three seasons, I mean, you can't get around the fact that he's been injury prone. Do you think, I mean, does that worry you at all? Where are you at on that?
I mean, obviously it's going to be somewhat of a worry. I mean, I think no matter what, if a guy's been injured a bit in his career, you're going to have that in the back of your mind. But I think this past season, at least for me personally, put a little bit of that to bed. He played 60 games. And so you're not injured if you play 60 games. And the Ducks even came out and said that they're not concerned about it. Bob Murray had said that a lot of the times that they were holding him out, it was almost precautionary reasons. And if you look at also the way that he was injured, a lot of the injuries they had prior in his career were his groin, those different types of areas, and those were none of the injuries this year. A lot of the injuries this year were him getting run, things that happen with contact. It's a physical sport. It's going to happen. And so it's not really like that's a big concern to me. And if my goalie plays 60 games a season and the other 20 are a mix of him just getting rest, him possibly quote unquote being injured, I'm not going to complain because he still played 60 games. That's the right most that I want my goaltender to play anyways. And so this isn't a scenario where he missed 40, 50 games this past season due to injuries and they're giving this contract, so I'm going to be really concerned. He played as much as you would want your starter to play.
Absolutely. And, you know, when people bring up the injury thing, at least in regards to last season, I always laugh a little bit because that's kind of the tell if you actually watched the games last season or not. Because if you watched the games and you saw the injuries, I mean, the one that really sticks out in my mind, I don't know if it was Blake Wheeler or Mark Scheifele.
It was Blake Wheeler.
Yeah, Blake Wheeler just goes flying into, so he's forechecking, and Gibson's looking the other way as his defense was breaking out the puck. And for whatever reason, Blake Wheeler just goes directly towards the net and takes out Gibson's, I believe it was his right leg. I mean, I guess Gibson is injury prone because of things like that. You know, how dare he not get out of the way? You know what I mean? It's interesting, the narrative around that. I mean, I think it is a legitimate concern because at the end of the day, those are all accumulated, you know, it's like a tax on his body. And so it's, you know, it'll be interesting. But so where I'm at with the whole thing is, you know, the comparable here that everyone's been making, and I don't think it's a great comparison, is the Carey Price contract. But if you consider, I mean, first off, Carey Price just turned 30, right? And the contract just kicked in for him. And we're talking about an 8-year deal worth $84 million, which is 14% of the cap, whereas Gibson, 8 years, same term, but only 8% of the cap. And Carey Price's contract carries a full no-move clause for the entirety of the contract. And oh, by the way, Carey Price is $70 million in signing bonuses throughout the deal. I mean, it's just, I don't think it's a comparable situation. No. Also, Carey Price has, I mean, now almost a career's worth of data to know basically what kind of goalie he's going to be. And there are, I would almost say in a way, and I'm saying this as someone who loves Carey Price, I think the injury concerns are more, they concern me more in regards to Price than they do for Gibson.
He's missed entire seasons. Gibson has never missed an entire season due to injuries.
And Price's injuries have been to his knee, you know, in particular. And those are things for goaltenders that, man, that can really catch up. Now, I still think Carey Price is going to be a really good goalie for most of this contract. He just seems to be one of those guys, but He just had one of, he just had his worst season statistically last year before this deal even kicked in. So anyway, all this to say, I'm a fan of the Gibson deal. I think, like you said, he's been one of the most underrated goalies the last 3 years. And he's going to keep the Ducks, as long as he's healthy, he's going to keep the Ducks really, really competitive throughout this deal.
Well, and I think a good comparison, I think we had mentioned this when this contract was signed, but was the Connor Hellebuyck deal.
Yes,
he signed Connor 6 years at 6.167, so Gibson's at 8 years, 6.4. And if you look at them, Hellebuyck only really has had this past season that was a good season for him. The rest of them, he was pretty average or below average.
Right.
Right. Whereas Gibson has been above average in each of the 3 seasons he's been with the Ducks and played a majority of the games. And so it's one of those things where Gibson, this is just my personal opinion, has been leaps and bounds better than Hellebuyck over the course of those 3 seasons they both have been up, and is only going to be making $300,000 less, or a little bit over $300,000, or a little bit less than $300,000 more than Hellebuyck. So I think overall it's a really, really good deal.
Well, that's the thing, is the injury concerns have to be what kept the dollar amount down on this deal. I mean, that has to be
probably
a large part of it. But it's a win for the Ducks, because even if it doesn't really work out, you know, I think it's a movable salary. Let's say things really get bad or a buyout situation. You know, the no trade clause isn't so restrictive. So it's something that you feel they can get out of. I mean, he is only 25 years of age, so I think that this, you're going to get pretty much his best seasons coming up now. And so that's pretty good news for the Ducks. All right, anything else on Gibson before we wrap up here?
Kind of a little side note on it is, granted, we probably knew this when he signed with the Ducks, but is this a sign that this will be Ryan Miller's last season with the team?
Well, so that is going to factor into the conversation we're going to have in a little bit here. It really, it kind of is just up to Ryan Miller in terms of how much money he wants to potentially not make.
He's 38.
He's 38, but he just had a really good season. And I mean, the thing with Gibson, though, is going to be, I think the Ducks have to prioritize really keeping his games played down. You know, if he hadn't been hurt all of last, you know, not all of last year, but if he hadn't gotten the bumps and the bruises he got last year, he would have probably played closer to 70 games. And I don't think that that's a recipe for success with goaltending in the modern NHL. So they're going to have to keep him below 60 games, in my opinion. And with Ryan Miller, as good as he's been, I do wonder, you know, can he handle playing 30, 35 games? I'm kind of skeptical there.
Yep. Agreed with that. I would think the only way that Miller would stay is if he would accept like a league minimum type contract, because I think now that the Ducks have Gibson locked up to this deal, they're going to have to be looking at guys that are willing to take something in the $1 million range moving forward to be the backup. It's not going to be a situation where you can have a guy on a $2 to $3 million contract as your backup goaltender anymore, just simply because you need to have that drop off a bit to make things work throughout the rest of the team.
Right, absolutely. So it's going to be an interesting situation now. If you look at next summer, the UFA goalies, there's going to be a lot of guys that the Ducks could potentially pick out as their backup who are maybe going to be cheaper and maybe just as good. I don't know. So it'll be interesting.
It's either going to be that, or they've drafted some goaltenders recently. There's Ole Eriksson Ek. There's Kevin Boyle within the system. They drafted
I think that is the plan.
Yes.
I think that that's probably what's the most likely outcome here. Now, that's a bit of a gamble because, you know, you're going to be asking these guys to play a big amount of games. And, I mean, do you trust Ole Eriksson Ek in 2019-20 to play 30 games in the NHL? I don't know.
Yep. Or is Kevin Boyle going to come up, play that backup role, and then Eriksson Ek is going to get some starting time down in the minors? I mean, and then we also saw the Ducks drafted two goaltenders this past draft, and someone had mentioned to me on Twitter when I was talking about the Gibson contract that they thought Gibson was going to be walking away because they thought they didn't see a contract like this coming, simply because the Ducks had signed or drafted two goaltenders, which was a sign they wanted to move on. And to me, it's the exact opposite. It's that they need to find a goaltender that can come up cheap, and if he is successful, you can trade him for some stuff. But even then, goaltenders take a while to make it to the NHL. They take probably about 5-6 years at least to develop before they make it to the NHL.
Right. And, you know, I think that with bringing a guy up, I think one thing to kind of monitor as a Ducks fan next year is just going to be the kind of the goalies in San Diego and how they're performing.
Yep.
So one little thing to monitor there. All right. So next bit of news here. Isaac Lundstrom, the first round pick for the Ducks this past draft, signs his ELC, to no one's surprise. Most likely will play next season in Sweden again. I think he still has one more year in his contract, something to that effect. Any thoughts there?
Not really too much. I mean, we have a question, and we can just get to it now that we're on the topic. But it was from Reddit, and it was from Betting Five. What do you think the thought process is behind signing Lundstrom to an ELC so quickly? Any positive or negatives from the signing?
Well, I mean, it's pretty much standard fare in the NHL that a first round pick gets signed to an ELC, the ELC contract right away.
Yep.
That's just the way it works.
The only way it doesn't, or reason it doesn't, is if they're still in college, because they can't sign the ELC until they're done with their college career.
Right.
But yeah, there's really no drawback to him signing this right now. I don't know if there's really a huge benefit either, besides him just kind of getting it locked down and not having to worry about it in the future. But I mean, for those that don't know, there's something called the entry level contract slide, which basically is if you're 18 or 19 by it's some date in September, and then you play less than 10 games in the NHL, then that contract slides to the next year. So even if Lundstrom, because he has never played junior hockey, he could actually come over and play in the AHL this year if he wanted to. He could play in the AHL this year and that season not count as a year off his contract because he had not played NHL games. So even though he's playing professional games, this year would not count.
Right. Yeah, so it's an interesting bit of work by the Ducks there, and I think that Lundstrom is a guy who it feels like he could be NHL bound sooner than maybe it. He doesn't feel like a project type player. I think he's going to be ready in a couple of years, but we'll see.
He may be a guy that they try to bring over to the AHL next season because he's eligible and can come over, even though he's going to be, I would assume, 19 at the time. So if he was a junior player, he wouldn't be eligible to play in the AHL, but I think he may be someone they bring over.
Yeah, we'll see. All right. So I think that's about as much as we can say to that effect. Now, kind of our last little topic here before we really jump into the questions. So Eric Stevens of The Athletic wrote an interesting article, and something that we've really been talking about for the past, I mean, months now, but the idea that with the Gibson contract and, you know, all the money that the Ducks have had to spend this offseason to keep their team together, both in terms of locking down young pieces like Montour, Gibson, and eventually Richie and Kasha, something that has yet to be done, interestingly enough. And then even a guy like Henrik getting locked down. All of that leaves Jakob Silverberg's future with the team in kind of a state of uncertainty, that he's on the last year of his deal, a UFA following this season, this upcoming season. And it feels like that right now the Ducks, before Kasha and Richie have signed their contracts, the Ducks are projected to have just about $13 million in cap space last season. But keep in mind that they will only have four NHL defensemen signed at that point, no backup goalie signed, and again, before Richie and Kasha's contract extensions are done. So the Ducks are going to be in a squeeze to bring back Silverberg. How much more is he going to want? I think there is a desire to keep him on the team. You know, Stevens talked about in the piece about potentially trading Cogliano to make room for Silverberg. Now, I don't know how realistic that seems, only because they just re-signed Cogliano and, you know, it feels like they want him around. Although Silverberg is younger, I think he'd probably be the one I want to keep out of those two. Now, the other thing that he brought up, just kind of probably more of a due diligence, but potentially buying out Corey Perry's deal at one point to make room. But there's only 3 years left in that contract, so we'll see. But all this being said, Jake, this is credit to you, because you've been beating this drum all season long, and now you've got Eric Stevens writing about it. So clearly there's maybe a little fire where there's smoke's coming from.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, he had mentioned that Silverberg wants, I think he said, around $5 million. He said, or that's what he thinks. basically he's just threw out $5 million as a potential dollar, whereas the Ducks want to get him underneath that that salary over 4 years. I think it's going to be really hard to get that done, because I think if Silverberg does hit the UFA market, I think he's a guy that could get in the $5.5 million range to around six. This is a guy that has scored 20 goals in his career. This is a guy that does the defensive work that GMs care about. And I think it's going to be really hard to kind of get that contract underneath $5 million annually. And I think if it goes over, the Ducks are going to be in a little bit of trouble cap-wise. And it's going to be one of those things where, like you said, it's going to be tough to make it work. You're going to have to move guys out, try to make some space. You're going to have to move probably a Cogliano. You're potentially going to have to move a Patrick Eves maybe. It's going to become real tough in the 2019-2020 and 2020-2021 seasons to make it work. And then you also have to factor in that 2020-2021 season. Brandon Montour is probably going to have a little bit of bump in his salary, because that's
exactly
when he's going to have it. And so it's a cascading effect, and it's kind of one of those things that you need to kind of address and assess what you have in your system, what you think can take those roles. Cogliano, yes, he can be traded, but that moves out 3.25. But then again, you also have to think about the fact that you have these kids like Troy Terry, Sam Steele, all these guys. They're going to need their second contract while Silverberg's still under contract.
Right.
If he gets 4 or 5 years. And so it's one of these things you need to project everything out. And kind of my whole basis behind thinking he should be traded is the fact that it really just hamstrings you. And it's a guy that, yes, he's good. Yes, I like him. It's not a thing of it's never been a thing of he should be traded because he's bad. That whole thought process that a lot of people have with this guy needs to be traded. Perry needs to be traded because he's bad, because his cap hits too high, all this different stuff. This isn't one of those situations. He's making a lot less than he should, 3.75. He probably, at his current play, he should be making in the $5 to $5.5 million. But it's one of those things that, is it better for the franchise to commit that money long term to him, or move him, get some assets back for him while you still can? Because if they don't trade him, he most likely will be gone next summer due to other teams offering him more money and more term.
Right. Well, that's the issue here, is that, you know, it's not impossible for them to re-sign him. It's just how much, if you're the GM of this team, how much maneuvering are you willing to do to keep a guy who on his best day is a really good second line winger who can, you know, kill penalty? Like, I don't, you know what I mean? Like, it's not a situation where, okay, even Adam Henrique, for example, is a guy that maybe you put in a little more work to keep him around. Silverberg is an impact player, but not a high-end impact player. And I don't know how much you really want to have to shake things up just to keep him around. And I think he is a guy worth keeping in the sense that what he brings to this team. Yeah. But when you consider all the work that might entail, the guys who could be coming up in the next 2 to 3 years.
Yep.
It feels like the writing is on the wall a little bit. I still wouldn't rule it out that the Ducks find a way to retain him.
But I wouldn't either.
It wouldn't shock me, but I just think that with where this team currently is, and I think they're in a bit of a transitional period, I think it would make a lot of sense to trade him like before training camp. You know, like get it done now, because as we know, the longer you wait during a guy's last season on a contract, the less value you're going to get in return. And so, I don't know. I mean, it's going to be interesting. I wonder if he's been chopped at all. Like, what do you think Jakob Silverberg gets you right now in a trade?
Well, I was going to say, we have a question on Reddit about this specific topic, asking kind of what we think, or maybe on Twitter actually, asking what we think his trade value is. And so, I don't know. It's really hard to gauge. I would think it would be something with maybe a mid-level prospect and a second-round pick, or a second and like a third-round pick, something along those lines. I don't know, but it's kind of hard to gauge.
Right.
It was from Kid3124 on Twitter. So yeah, it's just, he was wondering what value we think Silf has. And so I don't know. What do you think on it?
Well, I was actually going to say the same thing. I think it also kind of depends what the Ducks want. You know, do you want maybe do you just want a Jakob Silverberg who's locked up for another 2-3 seasons? Do you want a guy who's just kind of a middle six player who maybe is on the market right now and maybe the Ducks have to throw in a pick, but then they get cost certainty, you know, for a similar type player? You know, that could be one avenue. Or do you just want to trade the guy, like you said, for a pick and a prospect? I don't know. It really depends what the Ducks want. You know, what type of deal does Bob Murray see himself making here?
Well, here's kind of my argument for not doing the first option, but doing the second option that you said, is if you're trading Silverberg in the first place, you're trading him because you want to open up a roster spot and clear some cap space for people. So if you're bringing in someone that has a bit more cost certainty, that's kind of a lateral type move, if that makes any sense, as to just signing him.
But the Ducks also want to be competitive for the next, you know, the next, yeah, at least the next but, 3 years.
And but, so, but a part of that is you have to have kids come up and you have to have the youth come up in the system. And Bob Murray has kind of made that clear that he wants the kids to come up and he doesn't want them playing in fourth line roles. In order to do that, you need to move some guys out to open up roster spots for them. And right now there aren't any.
Right, absolutely. And I agree with that. But at the same time, if this team sees itself as a playoff team for the next 3 years, removing Silverberg right now and adding a guy who's not going to be on the team this year and a pick, that really hurts their middle six. I mean, the second line is basically going to be a shell of itself without Silverberg. And then you're hoping that the return of Patrick Eves can offset that some. You're hoping that Kasha takes another step forward, that Richie can kind of revive his NHL career to some degree. You're hoping a lot of things work out, and none of these things are impossible, but I just think that leaves a pretty big hole in the lineup without Silverberg. And I don't know, there's not really a guy on this in the system right now who can come in and I think be Silverberg, at least this season. I think starting next season, you know, 2019-20, you could see that, but man, I really think that's going to hurt them in the short term.
Yeah.
So agreed. That's where I'm at. That's where I'm at on it. It's not a bad move per se. It all really just depends where this team sees itself this season and moving forward. So anyway, that's where I'm at on it. That's all the topics we really have that I had written down. Oh, go ahead.
Let's jump on this really quickly. There's two things. One that I wanted to hit on, but another one George in our Mixler chat brought up that I actually hadn't seen yet. But he said, what did you guys think of the Craig Custance piece on the ranking of the Pacific Division? I don't know if you've seen this yet.
I've heard about it. I have not read it yet, so I can't comment on it.
It's interesting because he has the Ducks as the top-ranked team in the Pacific Division with 4.5 stars out of 5, and the Kings are at a similar place with 4.5 stars out
of 5. Well, so that ranking is based on he compares that team to the Cup winner.
Oh, that's correct. Sorry.
Right, and so it's not really a ranking per se. It's how many elements of the current champion does this team possess? And so, yeah, I mean, it's not. And even if you remove that, the Pacific Division is so wide open, and we're going to have plenty of opportunities to talk about this before the season starts. But it's a wide open field. The Ducks have the ingredients to be a team that makes it to the conference final. And then from there, all bets are off. So we'll see. It's not crazy to think that.
Yep. All right. And then the other thing I want to hit on was Corey Promen from The Athletic put out his NHL farm system rankings.
Yes. Very interesting.
Yes. And so he put the Ducks at number 24 in the NHL. So 24 out of 31. Last year, the Ducks, I guess, were at 21 on his ranking. And I don't know. How do you feel about that ranking overall?
You know, the more I think about it, the more it makes sense to me. I think you can quibble with the number itself, 24, but I think the Ducks are clearly, I don't think that they're a first-tier system right now. And it really depends how you're grading it, because there's a lot of guys in the Ducks' current system who have a real shot to be NHL players.
Yes.
But what do you want out of your system? Is it a steady funnel of bodies, or is it guys who can come in and make a serious impact?
I was just about to say there's no real game breaker
in the system. That's the thing. even even the biggest Troy Terry fan, who might be Jake Rudolph, or the biggest Sam Steele fan, I don't think anyone would say these are guys who have a chance at NHL stardom, a chance at being a top whatever player in the league. I just don't see that with any of these players, and I've gotten enough chances to see them play now, and we've got enough data, enough sample to know, you know, there is a universe maybe where these guys become legit, you know, first line guys, but that feels like a very small possibility in the range of outcomes here. I think the most likely outcome is that these guys become quality guys, quality players who have good NHL careers, but not necessarily real game breakers. Now, yeah. I feel like, for example, one guy that I'm high on is Maxime Comtois, only because he's shown a lot of improvement in one season, which makes me wonder, can he do that again another season? Because if he does that again, you know, that might shoot him up the list in terms of the Ducks prospect. Now, really, I really recommend going and reading that article, because it really talks about every player.
Yeah.
What I found the most interesting out of the article, and it's really something that that's been crossing my mind the last season. It's the fact that Jacob Larson was not so he had a couple of tiers. He had three tiers in terms of ranking the prospect. He had very good NHL prospect, legit NHL prospect, and what he calls have a chance. And Jacob Larson was not in those first two tiers. He's in the have a chance tier. And although he's posted good numbers at the AHL level, although he's dealt with injury, what I always found interesting last season is that he never got a call up in a situation where it could have very easily been him. And instead, guys like Walensky, guys like Pettersson were getting called up. And, you know, at the time, it did feel a little like maybe I was making too much out of it. But prominent being the plugged-in guy that he is, you know, talking to scouts constantly, being in those circles, for him to be, I guess, let that alone, this ranking is a bit concerning and also maybe a little more telling than we realized.
Yeah, I agree with that. I've been someone that's been high on Larson, so this kind of sticks out to me as being interesting. I think this year's really kind of, we've said this, but it's going to be a make or break season for Jacob Larson. I think this is the year that he needs to kind of make that impact.
Right. It's just the way he describes Larson is essentially a guy who can be a decent player, but, and this is something that we've talked about with Larson, is there's just not really, it's kind of, he's a Hampus Lindholm light, but in the worst way possible, where Lindholm doesn't really have, Lindholm has some obvious gifts, but he doesn't have that offensive flair that maybe a Montour has or a Fowler has. And so that maybe keeps him down from being one of the true top defensemen in the NHL. Larson is much the same, where he's a smooth skater, moves the puck well, but there's not that kind of game-breaking ability you want to see in a blue-chip prospect. And when you're not Hampus Lindholm, but that is your skill set, then that kind of can be an issue in terms of your NHL hopes at being a star.
Yeah, agreed with you on that.
So any other notes? I guess Max Jones being pretty low in the rankings.
Max Jones being pretty low. I thought his description of Troy Terry was interesting. For those that haven't read it yet, I'll just, the top two, which are considered very good NHL prospects, which are guys that could have a slight impact, are Sam Steele and Troy Terry. But on Terry, he said he's talked to some NHL scouts who feel he has the potential to be a true impact guy at the NHL level.
Well, we saw it this season. The games he played, he was noticeable.
Yep. And so I think that's interesting. And also the other thing of note, and I feel like Pronman has said this before, but that he believes Steele and Terry could compete for a job out of camp, with Terry likely getting the edge if it's just between the two of them.
Right, which is just kind of almost through no fault of Steele's, but it's just the way this roster is constructed. Yep. That fourth line spot just seems to be there for the taking. I'm high on Terry only because I think the tools he does possess, if he can improve them or continue to improve upon them, and then while also adding some size to his frame. He's already a pretty dangerous shooter. He's already a guy who looks to make plays off the rush. And if he can even get a little better at that, those kind of guys are usually pretty useful at the NHL level. So yeah, we'll have to see there. Anything else on this ranking, or should we actually get to our questions
now? Let's jump into the questions. We've got plenty. So, okay, let's do it. Christian W1707 on Twitter said, I think John Gibson is a top five goalie. What do you guys think? And he said, if not top five, where does he rank? Who is above him?
Oh, geez. I think he's definitely one of the best goalies in the NHL. I don't I would have to actually sit down and think about my ranking. Definitely top 10, probably top 5.
Here is something that I decided to pull up. Gibson has really come into the league and really started playing more games over the last three seasons. And so over those past three seasons, taking out guys who have played less than 100 games, Gibson has played 152 total over that span. There is only one goaltender in the league that has a better delta save percentage than him and a better goal saved above average than him, mm-hmm. and that's Sergei Bobrovsky.
Right, who is also very underrated.
Yes. And so Sergei Bobrovsky has saved 66.55 goals above average. Gibson's at 55.56.
Which makes you realize how good Bobrovsky's been.
Yeah, exactly. But I think top five is definitely about right. And you could make an argument for second based upon this.
Right. Well, it's goalies are so tough to rank because what do you value more? You know, the future performance, kind of what they've done in the past. I don't know. I still, my top three is probably still some order of Lundqvist, Price, and Bobrovsky. But, you know, as you can see, that can fluctuate so much year to year. Yeah. And then you've got guys like Rask, who also can be up and down. So I think Gibson is safely in the top 10, though. I think that that's without question.
Yeah, I would personally put him top 5, but I think that it all depends on what you're using to evaluate. If you're using the career, if you're using future, if you're using a lot of different stuff. If we're using future, Gibson could be top of that list.
I only use goals against average personally. So
I don't.
I'm just kidding. Oh, God. Let's not start this.
Nope. All right. So Kristen Hammonds comes in with a really good question. A lot of articles talk about how old the Ducks are. Do you consider the Ducks team old as a whole? And I think that this is an interesting perception question.
Well, I don't think that they're an old team per se, but I think that they are not. I wouldn't call them a young team either. I think that it's a team that's, if you look at the D, all the D now are pretty much in their prime. There's not really even Lindholm now is 24, right?
Yeah.
And again, that it sounds so morbid to say like, oh, he's not young anymore. But in NHL terms, he's not necessarily, a wide-eyed prospect anymore. He is an NHL player. He's an NHL regular. He is now pretty much in his prime. Fowler's 26. Manson is 26. Montour's 24. So really, and then you look at the third pairing, Schuster and Holzer, Shen, that whole grouping is definitely on the older side. And then, you know, really where the youth is there is going to be the prospects who could potentially come up. And then you look at up front, I mean, they're pretty old up front. I mean, that, you know, you look at Perry, Getzlaf, Kessler, obviously. Henrique isn't especially young. Cogliano, Eves. I mean, no one is really that young up front except for Raquel and Kasha.
I'm not sure that you would consider all those guys old. You wouldn't consider Schuster old. You wouldn't consider Luke Shen old. You wouldn't consider Henrique old. They're kind of in their prime years.
Exactly. But I wouldn't consider them. I wouldn't consider this a young team is what I'm trying to say.
But I think the question is, are the Ducks
they're neither old nor young.
Yeah, but I think the reason why a lot of articles talk about how old the Ducks are is that, for better or for worse, a lot of the times teams are perceived by their star players, by their big names,
right?
And that's kind of
which is not unfair, by the way.
No, but I think that with the Ducks, you have Getzlaf, Perry, and Kessler, and those guys are all 33 years old. And so I think that that's something that's interesting. I think that this team has gotten younger by getting rid of Bieksa, by getting rid of Beaujmais. And I think that does help on the blue line, because now the oldest guy on the blue line is Corbinian Holzer at 30. And I think that you take out those guys and the team does look a fair amount younger with the blue line being only young guys now. But I think that perception, it's going to be hard to change as long as Getzlaf and Perry are here, and that whether that's fair or not is up to you to decide. But I mean, you look at a team like Colorado, for instance, because Nathan MacKinnon's their best player. A lot of people will probably perceive them as being a young team, even if they have some younger guys or some older guys on their roster. And so it's right. A lot of times that's going to be the driving factor behind is where your core is at.
The reason why I think it's fair to a degree to look at it that way is because much of your team's ability to compete and to how long it can compete for is based on your top players. I mean, the reason that people, if Nathan MacKinnon is your best player, that means if Auston Matthews is your best player, if Jack Eichel, Connor McDavid is your best player, that means your window is wide open and you can essentially tailor your roster to that.
That's true.
When your best player is in his late 30s, that's kind of the window. At least that's the way we've been told that's how that works. And so I don't think it's unfair, and because those are the guys who make the biggest difference. I mean, without Ryan Getzlaff on this team, who's the best player? Ricard Raquel? Like, who is the second best player in the Ducks right now? It has to be Raquel, right?
Probably.
And so after that, you go down the list. So
in terms once of gets, forwards, at least.
Well, but those are the guys who usually those are where your stars are going to be. Those are the guys who are going to drive that force. But now,
yeah,
I don't know. I just think that how do you judge the Ducks window once Getzlaff starts declining? If that ever happens, it may never happen. Who knows? Then do you base this team's window on Raquel? I mean, does Raquel become the face of the team? It's going to be interesting. So, all this to say, Kristen, we're sorry we went on a tangent, but that's what we do here. I definitely don't consider this team old per se, but I don't think they should be viewed as a young team either. That's, you know, just I guess loaded with young guys on the roster.
George and Mixler chimes in. They're not old. They're not young. They're a midlife crisis.
Well, in some
that's
ways,
a good you, that's a good could, yes. good way to put it.
Right. Yeah. Well, I think that's kind of sums it up there.
Yeah. All right. So Nate's a duck on Twitter asks, top four defensemen and top six forwards seem pretty solidified. My challenge to you is try to predict who the bottom pairing defensemen and bottom six forwards will be with as much conviction as possible.
I like the challenge.
Yes.
I think, okay, I'm going to go all in here. So top six forwards, we know who that's going to be, correct?
Yeah, so...
Well, we actually don't know that because we don't know if Ryan Kessler is going to be ready to start the season.
We also don't know about Patrick Eves and where he's going to slot in. Okay. There's a little bit of uncertainty there, but I think we can
Here's my expected Ducks... This is my opening night.
Let's just go with the assumption that you've got Getzlaff, Perry, Raquel, Silverberg, Cogliano, yes. Kessler as the top six.
I'm literally writing it down right now just so I can have it in my head. So... First line, I think it's going to be Raquel, Getzlaff, Perry. Second line, of course, Cogliano, Kessler, Silverberg, assuming he's going to be healthy, which we don't know that by any means, but yeah. Let's just operate on that assumption. Third line, I think it's going to be Richie and then Henrique and then Kasha. I think that's your third line. And then your fourth line is going to be going to go out on a bit of a limb here, but I think we're going to see Patrick Eves on the left side, and then your center is going to be, I'm just going to go with Brian Gibbons, and then on the right side, I think it's Troy Terry. Boom. That's my opening night lineup. Now, I don't know if Terry stays in the lineup because it could end up being Eves, Gibbons, and Rowney, for example. But I think the fourth line, because that's really the intrigue, is going to be the fourth line. And I think it's going to be some combination of Eves, Gibbons, Terry / Rowney. I think that's what it's going to be. So that's my lineup. And then on D, I think you're going to see Lindholm, Manson, Fowler, Montour. And I think for opening night, Pettersson, Schenn. Boom.
There's no way Schenn plays over Schuster.
You think so?
There's no way.
He's a Randy Carlyle player.
Schuster's making more money.
That's true. I guess it could be Schenn, it could be Schuster, but I think it's
I don't
one
think
of those
it's
two.
Both.
Well, no, well, yeah, cool, because they're both righties. It's going to be one of those two, and I think it's going to be Pettersson. I think Pettersson's going to come in hot in camp and win that job. So there you go.
All right, so my prediction is I think the third line is going to be – I think Kasha is going to play on the left wing.
Oh.
With Henrique as his center, and then Troy Terry on the right wing.
Oh, he's doing the thing.
I'm doing the thing. Then okay. you'll get Patrick Eves with Brian Gibbons and Nick Ritchie.
Okay.
And then Eves can play on the right side.
That third line is interesting.
Yes. Because I'm basing that off the fact that Bob Murray made it clear he doesn't want kids on the fourth line, even though he wants kids in the lineup. So, and then for the bottom pairing, I'm going to go with Schuster and Larson.
Right. Okay. You're going Larson. Okay. Going Larson. Yeah. He could be given that chance. okay, here's something. Tell me what you think about this. So what if you move, let's say Eves just resuscitates himself and he ends up, they put him back with Getzlaf. So your first line ends up being Eves, Getzlaf, and Perry. What do you think of a third line of potentially Raquel, Henrik, Kasha, or Raquel, Henrik, Terry, or something to that effect?
I think it's more likely that Perry ends up on that third line and Raquel stays up with Getzlaf.
With Getzlaf, yeah.
And you get Perry and Henrik because they had some chemistry
prior. I think Getzlaf and Raquel are definitely worth keeping together, but I would be intrigued to see that line.
Yeah.
So, all right. Well, there you go.
Okay. So, last question from Twitter. This is actually piggybacking off of Kristen's question. This is from Eric the Hawk, a former host of this podcast, actually, way back when. One of the things the NHL featured after Gibson inked his new deal was his belief that the Ducks are capable of winning the Stanley Cup now. What percentage of a buyer are you on this sentiment? And then he said, over the life of Gibson's deal, what percentage?
So what was the sentiment? Can you just repeat that?
That the Ducks are capable of winning the Stanley Cup now.
Right now, this year?
Yes.
What percentage of a believer am I?
Yes.
I would say maybe 40%, 35%.
Yeah, I think underneath 50 is probably fair, just simply because of injury concerns with Kessler.
Right.
A lot of different factors with kind of uncertainty with the roster, but you have Gibson, you have Getzlaf, you have a chance.
I mean 35% might even be really high, maybe 25%.
But it's not saying what percentage do you think the Ducks have a chance of winning the Cup. It's just what percentage of a buyer are you of the sentiment?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I guess of the sentiment itself. So we're talking about next year over the life of Gibson's contract.
Two different questions.
Right. Okay.
One for next year. One for over the life of Gibson's contract.
Man, I would actually say my percentage would be higher for next year than it would be over the life of Gibson's contract.
I'd actually kind of go the opposite direction.
That's my dystopian view.
I'm going to go the opposite direction because... Really? Yeah, I mean, granted, there's a lot of factors at play, but it's some guys developing, the Ducks potentially going out. I think having Gibson provides you that kind of rock at the back end that allows you to bring guys in, that allows you to compete and be competitive.
Well, here's the thing. While I totally agree with that, you know, the problem is going to be over the next 8 years, you know, Ryan Getzlaf, however he either declines, stays the same, once he's out of the picture, one way or the other, whether it's because he's not the same impact player, because he retires, I don't know who's the next star of this team? Who's the next Ryan Getzlaf? There doesn't seem to be an heir apparent. And that's the problem. And it's kind of like any sport, but in the NHL, for the most part, you got to have star players.
Yep. I said, there's a lot at play with that prediction from me. I mean, the only benefit is the Ducks will have a lot of cap space.
Right. And so, you know, maybe you bring in a guy via trade. Maybe you bring in a guy via free agency. But realistically, this team, I mean, if they can't get one with the rest of Getzlaf's, productive years, they're either going to have to hit a home run in free agency, hit a home run in a trade, which we almost never see in terms of a star coming through trade, or just be really bad. I mean, those are basically the three ways you get a really good star player. And that's the way that the Ducks got Getzlaf. They got him through the draft. Now, obviously, different factors there, different time in the franchise, but I'm curious to see what post Getzlaf is going to look like, because really he is this team.
Yep.
And how he goes, they will go, because there doesn't seem to be a next in line, you know, whereas you look at teams around the league and, you know, even like the Leafs, for example, you know, you've got Tavares, who's on the kind of the older side, but you've got Matthews. So they're set. Anyway, so I'm still a buyer that this team can potentially do that in the next couple of years, but my percentage goes down as Getzlaf gets older.
Okay. Let's hit this really quickly. This is from Perry Ebeltoft, who's played in our games. He sent you and I a DM a bit ago.
Shout out to Perry.
Yes. So it's about, is John Gibson really that good? And he said, I think John Gibson makes plenty of spectacular saves, and I know his stats have been good, but he also appears to get out of position at times, which leads to more acrobatic saves that might have been otherwise been more routine if he was more economical. In contrast, I always felt Freddie Anderson was better positioned and made it look easier with similar results. Do either of you have insights on the nuances of goaltending that might provide some insights on this topic? So I don't know if you have a take on it. I've got some opinions on it, though.
I think Gibson's movement has gotten better in recent years. I think that when he first came to the NHL, I was not a fan at all of his game. I thought that, well, I didn't think he really had a game. He just kind of, he had incredible athleticism, incredible, reflexes. And I mean, credit to him that it got him to where he is now. But to be a truly great player, truly great goaltender who has longevity, that will only take you so far. You have to introduce really some type of structure to your game. And I think if you look at the work they did with Gibson going to last year, I think that he looks a lot smoother in the net. His movements, I'm still not a fan of it, but it's better and the athleticism is there. And I think anything he can do to really buy himself some more years, I'm sure he's working on it. And I think I'm sure that that's something that now they're even more committed to. So I think he's made some noticeable improvements. I think his rebound control has gotten a lot better too. He used to be very scrambly with that, but you know, because I would always compare him to Freddie Anderson when he was around, the reason I liked Anderson so much is because he was just so smooth in the net with his footwork and just, you know, sliding across the butterfly. But Gibson's getting there, and I mean, he's already so talented that, you know, that could really propel his career.
Yep, I think you kind of hit all the right points there. And I was someone who used to like Anderson better simply because of kind of the exact reasons that Perry had mentioned. But I think Gibson's done a really good job over the past 2 to 3 years since they traded Anderson to really kind of solidify his game, make him a little bit more solid, not kind of be as scrambly. And I think the numbers have shown that. You look at his numbers over that span, and his first season, I believe it was the year he split with Anderson, he played 40 games in 15-16. He had a .920 save percentage. Last season, or 2 seasons ago, he had .924. This past season, .926. So it's continually getting better and continually rising. And so I think he's improved over his career, and I think we're seeing him get better and better every year. I think a big part of it is he's become more economical in his movement. Like you said, one thing I'm very interested about, and Daniel from the site has brought this up, is that it looks like they are going to be reducing the chest protector this upcoming season. And so it's going to be a really interesting thing to see how all the goaltenders in the league adapt to this change, to not having as much padding there to block out the net. And I think guys like John Gibson are going to be able to adapt better than some guys that are more of the blocking style, because they have always had to kind of be able to make adjustments, use their athleticism. And I think that that's going to become more of a thing with the reduction in the pad sizes.
Yeah, I don't really buy that the equipment changes are going to do anything because they never seem to do really much. Like, the goalies are so good nowadays, and they've been making their pads smaller for years, and I don't think that's a bad thing, by the way, as long as they're still as protective.
But it hasn't been the chest protector, though.
People need to just realize, yeah, but goalies are going to find a way to cheat. I mean, like, even when they reduce the size of the chest protector, what goalies started doing is loosening the straps on the bottom, like on the back, so that way when you're in your crouch, it rides up, and that way your shoulders look bigger. I mean, goalies are cheaters. And I don't blame them. Having been a goalie myself, like, it's a position where you need every advantage you can get, and so they're gonna find a way to get her. It's kind of like hackers, right? It's kind of like cybersecurity. Cybersecurity and goaltending equipment is the same thing. The hackers are always one step ahead. And so I think that the goalies are going to find a way to cheat here. But for a guy like Gibson, his pads already aren't that big anyway. If you look at his chest protector compared to some other guys in the league, he's already a guy who looks smaller anyway. So I don't see this affecting Gibson specifically.
Okay. Let's kind of blast through these last couple of questions. Dan Elder, who's a good friend of the pod, said, if you could go to only one game this season, what would it be? Home opener or choose a retirement? My answer is really easy on that. It's the career jersey retirement. It's not even a question.
Yeah, I would probably just want to go to a game where they're wearing the third jerseys. That's about it. Mm-hmm. So whatever night that is.
All right. And so Nyan Matt asks, how bad of a start do you think the Ducks would need to have for Carlisle to get canned? What do you think is the bare requirement for Carlisle to get an extension? And then if he gets canned, who do we think replaces him?
I don't know. I mean, it's
hard to say.
It's a loaded question. I really think if the Ducks, for example, make the playoffs, and I think they have to win a round.
Yeah.
I think they have to, like, that's the bare requirement.
Yes.
They have to at least get to the second round for that to even be a consideration. Now, if they get swept in the second round, Carlisle's gone. If they maybe go down fighting, maybe he's got a better shot. But I think it's going to take a lot. I think it's going to take a very, very good season for him to be the coach of this team 2 years from now.
Yep.
And as far as replacements, I think Dallas Eakins is going to be that guy. Yep. I actually am starting to think that.
Yep. And then I think how bad of a start. I think if around Christmas time, the Ducks are significantly out of the playoffs, in the like 6 to 10 point range, that's kind of when I think we could see the move happen.
Yeah, it would have to be really bad. I mean, yeah. It would have to, and there would have to be no injury excuses either.
Yep.
So if guys are hurt, he's not getting fired.
And then the last little bit from him is, what kind of odds do you think there are of seeing Steele, Larson, or Terry for any real minutes this season? I think it's high.
Yeah. I mean, if you've been following along here so far on this pod, you could probably figure out what we're gonna say here, but. We're definitely going to see at least one or two of those guys this season playing a role in this team. I think that's a realistic expectation.
Agreed.
I don't think Jones makes the team, by the way.
I don't either. I think he spends an entire year in the AHL.
Yeah, and I think Steele maybe has a chance, but I don't see it personally.
I think Terry and Larson have the highest chance.
Yeah, yeah.
So, and that's kind of it.
All right. Well. Looks like we got through a bunch of stuff. A good pod.
Hour-long off-season pod.
Yeah, no, we had a lot to talk about today, and I'm assuming we're going to be back probably... where does this put our next pod at, Jake?
We'll figure it out. Keep an eye on Twitter.
Yeah, keep an eye out on Twitter. I guess... Okay, let's put it this way. I think the next time you're going to hear from us is probably going to be... I would say when Kasha and Richie get re-signed, I think that'll give us something to talk about. We may do a pod in the interim, just as maybe a questions-only pod, something like that. But we're probably going to, I don't want to say shut it down, but we're going to quiet down here for the next month because, you know, in a month from now, training camp is probably going to start. And, you know, at least we're going to get the prospect tournament. And, you know, things are going to start picking up in about a month. So
you'll be back to hearing us like every two or three times every week.
The next 4 weeks we're gonna get a little quiet, but I think once this, you know, and once that month threshold has been met, you're gonna get what you got last season, which is a pod after every game, sometimes more depending on breaking news. So we're not going anywhere, but we're gonna be maybe a little more quiet the next few weeks here. And Jake has some things in his personal life that, you know, kind of important going on.
A little bit important.
Let's just put it that way. So on that note. Thank you so much to everyone who participated today in asking questions. Thank you to our live audience on Mixlr. Always appreciate the additional banter. As always, check us out on AnaheimCalling.com, at AnaheimCalling on Twitter. That is our home base. The podcast, you can find it on the Apple Podcast app, as well as SoundCloud.com/ACPod. Search Anaheim Calling the podcast, either on Apple Podcasts or on SoundCloud to pull it up. You can find Jake on Twitter at ReindeerGames91. I'm on Twitter at Felix_Sicard. And that will do it for today, Jake. The pod should be up pretty shortly. So thanks a lot, guys. And we will be talking to you soon.
Bye.